Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of AU's Research Center, I want to thank you for attending today's presentation, Women and Distance Education, Issues and Perspectives. Before we get into the presentation, I'll just touch on a couple of upcoming presentations. Next week, May 10th, Kay Johnson and Elaine Magason from the library will be presenting Digital Libraries, Finding Your Way in the Electronic Labyrinth. Then 2 weeks later, on May 24th, Veronica Begg, David Brundage, and Linda McLeod-Bondock, along with Pierre Wilhelm and Tim Terry, are going to be presenting on AU's Write Site. That will be it, likely for this year until fall, and we are scheduling things for the fall. So if people are interested in presenting, there's a form online. You can have a look at it and fill in and request an opportunity to do a lunch and learn. According to the FOIP regulations, we need to inform you that today's lunch and learn is being recorded. The purpose is to allow people who are unable to attend to view the proceedings, which are available via Illuminate, and we will send out an all staff with a link to the presentation. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Gina Wong-Wiley. Gina is a faculty member in the Graduate Center for Applied Psychology, which houses the Campus Alberta Master of Counseling program. Her research interests include women in distance education, reflective practice in counselor development, and pre- and postnatal adjustments. She's a member of the Research Ethics Board, of the Graduate Studies Board, of the Graduate Student Research Fund, and is the research coordinator for the CAP program. She's been with AU for 3 years. I'm going to turn it over to Gina in about 1 second, just to let you know that we have some animation in today's presentation, which means we are going to try an application sharing within Illuminate, which means that we will be unable to take questions until the end of the presentation. At that time, we'll switch back over so that you can see the hands and the talking buttons, and we'll take the questions at that point. My pleasure now to introduce Gina.
Thanks, Deb. I'm really excited to be here and talk with you about some of my ideas around women in distance education. And when I am referring to women, I'm talking about adult female learners in distance education. I always enjoy my drive here to Athabasca. It was so beautiful this morning, and I also find everyone so friendly here at the university, so I'm just thrilled to be here. I'd like to welcome everyone as well who's online in the Illuminate world. Thank you for joining us. In the short hour, what I'd like to cover is an introduction to this presentation, to give a brief background into this area of focus, and to share a qualitative research study that we conducted in our CAP program that involved women in early motherhood who were completing their graduate counselor education. I'm also going to talk about some sociocultural perspectives and then end with some future directions for research and hopefully some rich discussion. As I'm just waiting for the slides to come up, I'll just continue on. Oh, here we go. Oh, here we go. I'm just going to scroll through these quickly as I've mentioned these here. Okay, so just to begin with, I think it's really important for me to acknowledge the graduate students who've been involved in this work with me, Carrie Orr and Roseanne Swanson, and also David Schaefer, who's been my research assistant and has contributed a lot to my knowledge in this area. So let me first tell you that I am a psychologist, and had you asked me 3 years ago, I would have had no idea that I would be involved in distance education, that I would be looking into researching it, and that I would be here at Athabasca University giving a presentation on women and distance education. I came to this area quite innocently, actually, in becoming a faculty member in the Distance Counseling Master's program, and noticing the significant amount of women that were enrolled in our program. Now, that's not uncommon for counseling graduate programs. Typically, around a ratio of 1 to 15 men to women are enrolled in counseling programs, so that's not uncommon. But what I was also noticing was that there was a significant amount of men and women in our program who were having children during the course of their study. My private practice focuses on pre- and postnatal adjustments for women, and so I was just really curious about what that experience was like for women who was combining motherhood along with their distance education. Myself, I've always been one to combine motherhood and education. In my doctoral studies, I was pregnant and, in fact, in labor during my doctoral candidacy. So I've become pretty good at multitasking since that time. So given my own context of combining mothering and education, it's really fostered a sensitivity for me in wanting to help facilitate success for women in education. So I guess this is my shorthand way of saying that I am no expert in this area. It's really a growing interest of mine, and my hope today is to generate some discussion and to have an exchange, a sharing of knowledge. I'm really humbled by the research that goes on here every day by many of you here at Athabasca University, looking at things like student online adjustment and other meaningful areas that contribute to the success of online students. I want to quickly clarify that by the term distance education, I'm using this as an overarching term to also imply things such as virtual education, online, blended, distributed, computer-mediated communication. There's lots of terms, but basically I'm using distance education in this presentation to signify that its primary mode is at a distance. And I'm employing Desmond Keegan's 5 characteristics of the DE environment, and he talks about there being a predominant separation between the teacher and learner, that there's a plan for curriculum and support services, and that the medium, there's print, audio, video, or computer used for two-way communication, and that there's a predominant absence in there being a learning group that processed through the education at the same time. So just to continue on with some of the background to my perspectives in this work, the theories that inform my work include social justice, feminist epistemology, and as well as a human ecological perspective, which I don't have on the slide. In terms of social justice, this means that I recognize the socio-political issues that impact women in distance education. Feminist epistemologies, I'm informed by gender studies, women's studies, feminist theories, and that as well, there's an ethic of caring involved in the work that I do, whether it be with research collaborators or research participants. Carol Gilligan, a feminist research psychologist and professor at NYU, talks about the significance of girls' and women's voices, and this is also central to my work, and so predominantly I focus on qualitative research. A human ecological perspective is also really important to me in my work. My master's is in human ecology, and what that means is that I regard the multiple layers of influence on an individual within their development. So the individual is affected by their family, their community, and the larger cultural sphere. So the micro, meso, exo, and macrosphere, which it can be likened to Bronfenbrenner's human ecological schemata. So in my review of the literature, I noticed that 1988 appeared to be a time of change when there became an increasing awareness of feminist issues in distance education. What I saw was that there was the first published anthology, case studies of female distance educators as well as female learners internationally. At the CAID conference in 1988, there was also a first public discussion of gender issues. And Kirkup in the UK talked about the importance of having feminist goals for distance educators. So feminist perspective since this time has been influencing distance education. I want to just quickly turn to some statistics, and no one here will be surprised to hear that it's reliably estimated that over half of the several million learners who make up the world's population of distance education students are women. And Vaughan Prima from the UK talked about that since the early days of the open and distance universities, women have been seen as forming one of their primary constituents. Quite often these women had restricted access to traditional education because of responsibility for family, children, as well as sick and or elderly. And it is seeming that the percentage of adult female minority learners is on the increase. Now, the typical distance education graduate student is defined as female between the ages of 25 to 44 years of age, full or part-time employed, and married. I recently reviewed a report by AU providing some statistics and pulled this table that examined the combination of age and gender. And so indeed, we can see that between the age range of 25 to 44 years of age is the large majority of the representation at AU, and that the dark blue bars represent the female. Now you'll notice that the CAP program, of which I come from, isn't included in the statistics here. And I would say about 87% of the 500 student body population are women in our program. So if we were to be added, the blue, because we do represent the age range of 25 to 44, so in that, the mid, it would spike even higher, the dark blue, if CAP was included. Speaking of our program, I just want to give you a little bit of background into the CAP program. We are a Canadian collaborative inter-university distributed program. Our mission is to enhance accessibility, flexibility, and responsiveness to graduate counselor education, so for those interested in becoming professional counselors or counseling psychologists. Structurally, our administration, our instructional student services and resources are distributed among three universities, Athabasca University, University of Lethbridge, and the University of Calgary. We are the first joint degree across Alberta universities. Students complete 12 half courses. Within those, there are two practicum, counseling practicum courses, and of those courses, each of those have two weekend face-to-face seminars. And then there's a three-week summer institute component to several of the first-year courses. Our program length is, on average, 3 years, but students can accelerate the program and complete it in 2 years, or they can decelerate the program to a maximum of 6 years. Some flexibility there. So I'd like to turn now and talk about some of my motivation in terms of why I think it's important to look at this area of study. First and foremost, distance education has been found to impact women's self-identity and esteem, and I'll talk further about this a little bit later on in the presentation. And a recent, actually very recent, a March 2006 COT report by the Educational Review published some statistics on universities and campuses across Canada. They involved Canada, United States, Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and what they found was that Canada actually ranked the lowest in terms of having full-time academic women involved. The United States was at about 40%. So there is a significant underrepresentation of women in our colleges and universities. And it's fairly tacit knowledge that a positive graduate experience would lend itself to a woman wanting to seek further graduate studies, to wanting and being interested in lifelong learning, and then even conceiving of a career and possibilities in academia. So for this reason, I think it's really important that we support female graduate students. Next, Athabasca University's mission includes removing barriers to access and fostering success in university-level education. And overall, distance education is promoted for its flexibility and accessibility. So it's really important to examine factors that contribute to success of women completing DE programs. And lastly, purely from a retention perspective, DE program success involves keeping students and seeing them through to program completion. The more we support student success, the less the attrition rates. And so turning now to look at some of the barriers, because when we think of success, this involves understanding what barriers are in place that we need to try to remove. Muhlenberg and Bird did a large factor analysis study, including 1,056 participants. 69% of those were women, and 52% were graduate students. And they found 8 underlying constructs that make up student barriers to online learning. And these included such things as administrative issues, social interaction, academic skills, technical skills, learner motivation, time and support for studies, cost and access to the internet, as well as technical problems. So quite significant findings, 8 barriers that can help inform us in terms of how we can better foster student success. Now, I always go back to Patricia Cross's categorization of barriers, and she did a study that looked at what the barriers were in place for the adult learner to access participation in education. She didn't focus on women, nor did she intend to look at distance education. But what I think is that her conceptualization can be generalized and used in understanding some of the barriers for women in distance education. And looking at these 8 barriers, I think that they can easily fall into the categorizations that she talks about. And she found 3 distinct barriers, and they included dispositional, institutional, and situational barriers. So she described situational barriers, and again, I'm applying this in a general way to women in distance education. Dispositional barriers were the attitudes and self-perceptions that people have of themselves as learners. So those belief systems where I'm too old to study, I've forgotten, it's too expensive, it's too hard, I'm going to be really isolated, those kinds of beliefs that people have in their minds that serve as barriers. And then Cross talked about situational barriers, and these were defined as personal factors such as home and workplace responsibilities that work against student participation. So such things as access to childcare, the necessary supports, financial constraints, and those kinds of things. And I'm going to come back to situational barriers in a moment. She also talked about institutional barriers, so difficulty accessing necessary services. So things like counseling support, financial support, understanding the system administratively, those kinds of things. So looking back at situational barriers, I thought for a moment when I was considering Cross's categorizations that this one was really significant, and that indeed there are a lot of personal factors in the home and workplace that impede on women's accessing of distance education. And as I thought more about that, it seemed to me that there were more than just personal factors, and that there are, in fact, sociocultural factors that serve as well as barriers. And what I'm talking about here is the prevailing ethos of our culture that promulgate various beliefs. So such things as unrealistic standards and expectations that impact women in distance education, and women in general, I believe. For example, one of the biggest challenges and primary sources of stress for female distance education students all over the world comes from multiple and conflicting roles, which I believe is consistent for men as well. Nevertheless, in the United States, women still perform 70 to 80% of the childcare and domestic work. So this was conceived to be about 64.7 hours a week in paid employment and domestic work. And of course, there's no guess that this would have a significant impact on the amount of stress in a woman's life, particularly when women who study at a distance have been found to have less time for themselves than women in traditional programs. The only way that they can accomplish this third shift, as Kumari defined it as, is to fit education when and where they can. Now, the impact of stress can range from things as decreased motivation, inability to cope, to heightened potentials for things like disordered eating, substance abuse, cardiovascular disorders, cancers, psychophysiological disorders, for example. So I'm focusing on one perspective, the sociocultural issues that I think could add to Cross's categorizations. But I think there are many other aspects that influence women in distance education. And in trying to capture the essence of the complexity and the multiple layers, I stayed with Cross's categorization of the 3 situational, dispositional, and institutional barriers, and thought further about these barriers and wanted to broaden them to include an ecological perspective, so having within each layer the micro, meso, exo, and macrosphere perspective. And so I'd like you to keep in mind that this is a preliminary conceptualization that I'm working towards, and I really invite feedback or comments and insights that you might have as I share this. Well, I guess at the end, since I'm going to power it through this and have questions and comments at the end. So first, opportunity is very integral for a woman, as well as accessibility and ability. And by opportunity, I mean basic human rights. So women having freedom of control over their own bodies, anti-domestic violence, providing available birth control, as well as equal opportunities and rights for all women, so freedom from subjugation and oppression to pursue education, working towards enhancing women's status, social justice issues. Religious tolerance, I think, also impacts the opportunity for women having access to distance education. So things like Islamic, Christian, Buddhist, humanistic beliefs and values coexisting. Eliminating and attempting to reduce prejudice and racism, I think, also has a great impact on women's opportunities. Political, economic, and legal stability, so peace and prevention of war, democratic rights, partnership among countries. The Center for World Education at the University of Vermont is doing some really interesting work in this area. Now, turning to the accessibility sphere in terms of looking at factors that influence women in DE, this could include technological advances, such things as there being internet access in rural communities, poverty alleviation and for women, so such things as funds for women to access education, education for underprivileged women, having evolving accessibility standards and technology in distance education, so those with visual impairments, color blindness, speech and hearing problems, cognitive delays could still have access to quality distance education. Infrastructure and capital resources also important when looking at the spheres of influence. And turning now to ability, literacy skills is important, very critical to women accessing distance education. One of my sort of mentors, I guess, in the area of philosophy of education is Paulo Freire, and he wrote The Pedagogy of the Oppressed and likened literacy skills with the emancipation of the oppressed, and so reading opening up doors and the world for individuals. So her learner style will also impact her ability to access distance education, her skills to navigate the virtual technology, dispositional qualities, her motivation, self-organization, self-reliancy, those things identified in the literature as being really integral to student success is important. Her personal values will also come into play, as well as role expectations, which I'm talking quite a bit about today. Her family, occupational context, her socioeconomic status, the accommodation for women with visible and invisible disabilities, and of course the resources and support to develop some of these abilities is predominantly in this sphere. Many of them are things that can be enhanced in a woman's life. So again, this is an infancy conceptualization, and I welcome your comments. Turning now to the research literature on what can be done to support female learners from a micro perspective, so from women's own perspectives of what they think can help them through distance education. First, Bow in 2002 conducted a study and found that female learners wanted communication and interaction with instructors, other students. Technical support was critical, as well as support services from campus. Personal support from partners, family members, and employers was also very significant. Similarly, Craig and Drewsison and Fraser found similar findings. They regarded family support, institutional support, particularly from the instructor, and employer support as being critical for them to be able to add the role of student to their multiple roles in their lives. There were 573 participants in their study, and they identified 5 roles and that those types of supports allowed them to add student. So worker, spouse, mother, caregiver, volunteer were the roles that were identified. I'm focusing on the role of mother for a moment, given that this is primarily what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the presentation. I wanted to give a little bit of a background. And there are a few experiences in a woman's life that parallel the adjustment and transition to mothering. Women vary greatly, of course, in their experience of pregnancy and of mothering. A reported 20 to 30% of women experience some depressive symptoms in the postpartum period. Stoppard noted that long before a woman has a child, cultural messages have begun to shape how she will form her identity as a mother and how this fits in with her identity of herself. There seems to be deeply ingrained cultural myths related to motherhood. So there are moral standards of good versus bad mothering. For example, there are prevailing norms that good mothers consistently organize their lives with their children as the priority, and feminist researchers have argued that the bulk of the responsibility for children's growth, development, and their behavior rests with mothers. And so women internalize this and sometimes blame themselves and are blamed when aspects of these don't go well. Our culture promulgates the ideal of a good mother. Furthermore, attachment parenting and other cultural pressures further this ideal, and these greatly influence women's ability to access and continue in distance education. Research also indicates that women will drop out or scale back their involvement in DE when demands of family and home require it. May in 1995 conducted a qualitative study involving 9 females in distance education, and these women overwhelmingly reported that the household and childcare responsibilities rested with them. One woman in this study talked about how her husband, her partner, had at one time also been enrolled in distance education courses, and then she at another time. And what she distinctly noticed was that there was time and respect given for him when he was studying at home and not the same accommodations for her when she was studying at home. And so she had noted that within the research study. And this is not to say that men don't experience or wouldn't experience the same kinds of pressures if they were under the same expectations. However, the research still shows that women perform primarily the childcare and domestic roles within heterosexual relationships. Finally, looking at additional challenges in parenting and distance education. There is talk in the literature about negotiating the home as a full-time school, work, learning, and living environment, and that the childcare responsibilities often fall to the partner learning at home. There's also an interesting negotiation that happens around the placement of the work-school space. Probably the kitchen isn't the ideal space, but under the stairs, and as much as one could define the barriers, it's still not a private space. And then there's self-concept maintenance in this time of incredible roles and balancing and juggling. Personal growth and awareness can be challenging. And then as I've talked about, motherhood is culturally imbued with predetermined roles, tasks, and expectations. So I'd like to turn now to discuss a preliminary qualitative study conducted in our program on combining early motherhood and distance education. We received AUREB approval for this interpretive constructivist qualitative study that was guided by feminist and constructivist perspectives. We were curious about the experiences of women enrolled in our program who experienced early motherhood as they pursued distance education. We were curious about the barriers as well as the facilitators in their experience, and we wanted to understand whether there were indeed situational, dispositional, institutional, and sociocultural barriers. Participants involved, again, this is a preliminary study, 3 women, Grace, Samantha, and Lynn, who were married, urban living, in their 30s, midway through our program, and defined themselves as stay-at-home mothers. All 3 participants experienced pregnancy and the birth of a newborn, at least one, during the course of our program. Demographic information was collected, and an in-depth, semi-structured interview guide enabled us to collect narratives of the women's experiences. and a voice-centered relational method that was derived by Carol Gilligan was used, where the transcripts were read four times, each with a different lens in mind in looking at the information that the women provided. Trustworthiness was enhanced by member checks, so the women were provided their transcripts. They were also provided the plot lines that were developing, as well as other findings, and able to talk about the accuracy and the meaningfulness for them of the findings. As well, the researcher memo and audit trail was also used to enhance confirmability and trustworthiness of our study. So in terms of results, indeed, situational, dispositional, institutional, and sociocultural barriers were identified. For situational barriers, the women talked about lack of support from some family members. Dispositional barriers, lack of self-confidence in her learner skills was identified for earlier on in the program. And institutional barriers, the women talked about there being a lack of student support services, so for example, access to personal counseling. And for sociocultural barriers, the women identified that they did indeed feel pressures related to unrealistic beliefs, standards, and expectations from themselves and from others. And they talked about managing these pressures through using cognitive strategies. Of course, they're developing counselors, so using self-talk. Saying things like, I'm not going to be the perfect parent. It does not exist. And by striving for personal control over their life situation and educational choices. And you'll just note that I use striving for personal control, and I'll share some verbatim quotes from the participants which have some contradictions about how much they actually did have control. So what did the women say in terms of their experience of combining early motherhood and distance education? They said their experience was wonderful, phenomenal, fulfilling, and rewarding. Nevertheless, concurrent with the literature, these women gave examples associated with multiple role strain, and they were used such words as chaotic, crazy, and overwhelming to describe juggling their multiple roles. The shared plot lines or themes that were consistent through the three women's experiences included, being a mother is my number one priority. All the women talked about that. They also talked about being a more confident individual, which I'll speak more to a little bit later on. They said that sometimes each role doesn't get what it should, and that it's a choice that I really want to make, it being staying at home, being a mother, as well as DE. Expectations. This word was described overwhelmingly in their experiences in feeling the expectations and pressures. And lastly, the importance of surrounding themselves with positive, supportive people. So as I said earlier, the women used cognitive strategies and talked about having choices. But it seemed to be evident that the women in this study still had to fit in their education when and where they could. And I'll share some verbatim transcripts. One woman shared, usually the wife comes last because I have no choice. I have to take care of him, meaning her son, and school deadlines and those kinds of things. I try to restrict my hours from school and try not to become like obsessive compulsive with checking the mail and discussion forums, you know, setting my time when I'm going to post and not always being on the computer because I can get carried away. So for this participant, it seemed as if being a parent helped her keep in perspective her role as a student and not to kind of overindulge in that experience. But at the same time, she talked about having no choice. So interesting there. And then next, this participant similarly talks about, I don't want my husband to think that school is getting in the way, so I'm also very organized about things like laundry and stuff like that. I'm more organized when I'm in school than when I'm out of school because, for instance, when my kids have their naps in the afternoon, I know that I have 2 hours. So it's always the same kind of thing. Quickly get the kitchen cleaned up from lunch. I put in a load of laundry. I fold one load. I put it away. I tidy up the toys. I sit down and I do a good hour and 10 minutes on the computer or whatever. Aside from this woman being pretty amazing. And also, it seems as if being able to fit it all in. But again, talking about how not wanting to give the impression that school is getting in the way of these other things in her life. Now, the women talked about features within our program that facilitated their having positive experiences. And so first of all, they talked about our family-centered leave of absence option, where a student can take 1 year, 6 months leave of absence and still have continued access to online resources. We also provide extensions for program length, as mentioned. They can decelerate their program up to 6 years. In each course, they're also allowed to have 1 week free from discussion forum postings. We also offer family student housing options for on-campus based portions of courses. We provide reasonable extensions for assignments and have electives that are interesting to parenting roles. And they talked about the significance of having academic advisors who understood the multiple roles of women. So these were nice to hear, I guess. These were some of the things that we were doing well. One participant said, I just feel that this program is so open to all those different variables in your life, because some programs might not be that open to the fact that women have babies while they are taking courses. Some things that they wished our program also included, they wished there were childcare facilities for on-campus sections of programs. They wished there was alternative options for on-campus sections as well. Some of the women talked about the challenge of nursing and co-sleeping and how the campus sections presented some challenges for that. And they wanted better access to personal counseling, particularly for rural students. And they also shared some survival methods. And so these were categorized into self-talk messages, which again loosely fits into dispositional barriers. Leave of absence options, again, situational. Role enhancement strategies as well was also used. So just to briefly go over these, self-talk messages that these women used, they would say to themselves, I'm not going to be the perfect parent or student. And just related to this, I was going to read, homework is the least of importance in reference to the other things in their lives. They also reminded themselves that they need to take a step back and reflect. And I can ask for help. So these self-talk messages helped enhance the experience for the women and helped remind them in what their priorities are and what's important. Leave of absence options, the women talked about this being a very helpful thing and that it's important to take time off to adjust to motherhood. One participant who didn't really regretted not having done so, and she said, I don't remember because I simply did the work to do the work and not had the time to really learn, because you're doing it to survive basically and you're doing the minimum. You do your posts and not worry too much about it. So she felt in retrospect that not taking the leave of absence options decreased her experience of learning quite significantly. Okay, so sorry, the quote that I wanted to pull up just came up, and I wanted to share one participant saying, I just feel sometimes that you have to be this perfect. You know, you never yell at your children. You have to feed them your 3 meals and 2 snacks a day. And of course, I would not do anything other than that. And I just felt that everything has to be so perfect. And at the same time, you have to be fit and healthy and look good. And, you know, you have to be a wife. And this is not coming from my husband, but from society. And so I wanted to share this where one of the self-statements was, I'm not going to be the perfect mother or the student. And so that sense of there being these cultural pressures on the women was talked about quite significantly in the research. Finally, strategies for role enhancement that the women used. They talked about developing an organizational time management system, scheduling specific time for school work, putting school in its place and was clear about their priorities. I took the program slowly at my pace was also shared, and scheduling family time was also important for balance, and completing school work in blocks of time. So these helped for them to juggle the multiple roles in their lives. Some of the limits of the research, you'll note that the three women were quite homogeneous in being Caucasian, middle class, heterosexual, and married. As well, they were stay-at-home mothers, which there's nothing wrong with. However, in my interest in wanting to look at the third shift with work, paid work, home and family responsibilities and distance education, this research didn't quite capture that. So still much to do in this area, but I think that this research does lend insight and as qualitative research doesn't generalize, so not to other women in our program nor to other women in other programs, but important nonetheless. One interesting or significant finding that I wanted to end off with in terms of this research study is the document entitled Brave New Women of Asia, How Distance Education Changed Their Lives. And in this document, they discussed how adult education impacted women's confidence and in turn their mobility, their ability for expression, enhancing their decision-making, their responsibilities, which really improved their own lives as well as the lives of their family and their communities. Picciano once described success in distance education as an individual completing a course or a program of study, but indeed it is much more, as the women in our small study confirmed. It enhances her self-confidence, provides and opens up new perspectives and opportunities, promotes diversity and tolerance, and enhances her personhood. So it was interesting that as enrollment in distance education impacted her identity as a mother, at the same time her choice to continue in school furthered her identity beyond motherhood. So it's kind of an interesting relationship happening there. Just a bit of discussion and some micro and macro recommendations. From a micro perspective, positive role balance is talked about in the literature. And so this is becoming fully engaged in the performance of the role in one's total role system. And this is associated with lower depression, heightened self-esteem and confidence, and general well-being, as well as role enhancement. And that includes that the more roles that there are, the more rewards and privileges and higher psychological well-being that is possible. And then also the belief that the aspects of one role contributes to performing another role in an even greater way. And I think that was something that was shown in the study in terms of motherhood was enhanced by the women's participation in education and back and forth. Von Pruma in the UK also discussed the importance of women sharing their experiences and mutual support and encouragement. I think this sharing could also be useful for putting domestic and mothering roles into perspective and to risk being less than perfect. Kramari also talked about a buddy system in where successful female students would buddy up with incoming female students. However, in addition to individual change, I believe we need to examine the prevailing ethos of our culture around mothering. Feminists and social scientists interested in work-family issues have also pointed out that we need to progressively work towards changing the cultural image and expectations of women and mothers, and advocating for making active decisions so that women can extract their self-worth from these expectations, as well as the importance of encouraging and advocating for men's roles to change. My hope in this area is to gain more in-depth understanding, and my interest in psychological, sociological, and cultural perspectives, and using these in ways to understand how we can advocate for women and mothers in distance education and to enhance their success in their experiences. And I think that there's much more to do in this area of female e-andragogy, the adult learner. Again, more that has to be done in the experiences of women in distance education and early motherhood and many other areas that also connect with this important topic. What I wanted to end with was sharing my unifying vision and underlying tenet to this work. And earlier I talked about opportunity, accessibility, and ability, and that these are interconnected and interrelated in terms of the spheres of influence impacting women in distance education, and that there's a central overlay there. And from there emanates a vision of Ubuntu, which is an ancient South African concept from Zulu-speaking peoples, which is a world vision of humanity regarding each individual's humanity ideally expressed through his or her relationships with others. Ubuntu means that people are people through other people. It acknowledges both the rights and responsibilities of every citizen in promoting individual and societal well-being. Ubuntu is a vision that inspires my work and my hope for women in distance education. So thank you.
We will transfer back over to the standard Illuminate now and take some questions.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I think that was just excellent, excellent, Gina. I liked your presentation as well as the content. I haven't got a great question at the moment, though.
Thanks, Carolyn. If it's all right, I see a hand here, yes.
I noted that you allowed your participants to review their statements. Did you permit them to elaborate on them afterwards? And did they have access to other, wait, yes, you said that they had access to the study as a whole. Did you find that when they were responding to the study as a whole, it drew out certain themes that they might not have mentioned in the first instance themselves? And if so, does that affect the validity of your study?
Good question. Indeed, the women were provided with the transcripts of the interviews. All of them, I think, reviewed it in detail, and you'll have to understand that it was about a 3-4 hour interview, so there was quite a bit of transcripts for the women to go over. None of them had requested any changes, but they all did say that they were fine with the research going on. They didn't feel like they wanted to delete any of the information or add any information. Likely now, after the study is out, they might have some further ideas or want to say more. And I think that's part of the process of research, is you capture one moment, a snapshot in time. And hearing some of the other women's perspectives and some of the discussions in the literature, they might have more to add. And, in some cases, it would be really great to go back to them and talk with them more about their experiences. And I do hope to carry on the study and open it more broadly, given this was a preliminary study, and further invite women in our program into the study.
I have one more little comment. I think I understand what you meant. One of your projections said that women would extract their self-worth from expectations. Now, to me, that's an ambiguous statement. Do you mean that they would separate their self-worth from the expectations placed upon them, or that those expectations would form the basis of their self-worth? It's just, I find the statement ambiguous.
Okay, fair enough. That suggestion was a recommendation that came out from reviewing the research data and from a macro perspective in what can help start reshaping and reconceptualizing worth for women. And I'll give you an example of what I mean about this. I can think of hosting a party, and I think that in some women's experiences, there's some expectations around what the environment would look like, what kinds of things might be served, and I'm using this kind of loosely as a metaphor, and there's sort of this expectation that's written out there, even though no one maybe specifically has talked to her about that. And then when that happens, there's reinforcement in different subtle and maybe even direct ways of that happening or not happening, and how the guilt or shame when it doesn't happen can affect a woman. Now, there are those who, it doesn't matter, they can host a party and, you know, the place can be in whatever shape and it doesn't feel as if it's a sense of representation of the woman's competency or her self isn't identified in that particular aspect. And so in mothering, there's good mothering, the ideal of the good mother that's portrayed out there, and it's kind of this script that isn't written directly but is implied in so many ways and subtly in our culture. And so when I'm talking about that self-worth extraction, it's thinking about that using self-statements and knowing, okay, well, so the house is a mess. You know what? I'm doing important things. This is my focus. So that kind of idea, I don't know if this is answering your question, but that's where I was coming from in talking about that recommendation.
You have to realize I'm an editor, so words are really important to me.
I'm just going to break in here for a second. We have two people waiting. Cheryl, we have your question, and then Kathy, we've got you listed as number two.
Can you hear me?
Hello?
I'm trying to ask a question. Can you hear me? Oh, I have to turn this off. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Gina. I think that was a really, really interesting presentation, and I really liked how you fit your results to the barriers described by previous researchers. I can't say a lot about your model, but I did have a question. There was something that you said that surprised me a fair bit, that only 32% of full-time academic students are women. And I had thought that I was surprised to hear that because I thought that it was the other way around, that people are now being concerned that there aren't enough males going on to post-secondary.
Thanks for that question. I think it's just a matter of clarification. As I was talking about the COT report, the Educational Review that just came out in March, talking about the underrepresentation of women in academic full-time tenure positions rather than students. And so when I was discussing students, I was talking about the importance of supporting graduate students so that they can further into areas of academia. Does that clarify?
Yes, thank you. That makes a lot more sense. Yeah, thanks.
Kathy, go ahead, please. Kathy Bray.
Hi, Gina. Thanks very much for your presentation. I'm really pleased to hear the historic sweep of the work on gender and distance education. Thanks for starting back in 1988 and showing the changes that have happened. I just wanted to make one comment and one little a suggestion about the model and then one question. The comment being that the change that I notice in the study of women in distance education or gender in distance education is that there seems to be in your study a lot more focus on choice and also changing expectations of self. I think that women are finally getting the message that we can choose more about what we do and we can choose not to be perfect. So it was great to hear that coming through in your study. The little suggestion about the model, I was really pleased to hear, Gina, that you made the comment about people with disabilities and women with disabilities in particular. I think you noted that under the ability section of the model, but you did mention accommodation for disabilities. So in that, I think you're recognizing that barriers with respect to disability are institutional rather than individual or dispositional, and I'm sure you recognize that. So I just think that the comment about disability should be included in the institutional part of the model. And my question is, it was so good to hear you emphasize the quote around taking time off after you've had a baby, because in recent years, especially in the Masters of Integrated Studies program that I teach through Athabasca, there have been a number of women that have recently given birth or indeed give birth during the course of the studies, and I'm always kind of concerned about what I should say and how I should support these students, and because I want to, with many of them, say, take a year off. And yet, on the other hand, I know that you've also recommended that we change the ethos of mothering. You know, in other words, recognize that mothering should be shared with parents, with the community, and also recognize that, you know, you can do other things and be a mother at the same time. So if my question is, shall I suggest taking the time off? I mean, obviously, it's a conversation with students. And secondly, if we recommend to students, especially at the master's level, to take time off, are we buying into old-fashioned notions of mothering? And I guess that's for you, Gina, and for anyone else. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Kathy. Those are really great questions and suggestions. I really like the one of including dispositional barriers within the opportunity sphere, and I think that's what you were suggesting, because it was in the ability and accessibility, but that it's also an institutional issue to be dealt with as well. So thank you for that. And your challenging question of what to say to master's female students once they have babies, and I know that this is something that I struggle with in talking with students in our program, because of course you don't want to prescribe anything. But for me, I always ask questions around what types of supports that they have, what kinds of ideas in terms of their future, you know, finances, because all of those things are important. And while we can say take time off if you can, for some women that isn't as much of a choice because of other factors happening for her in her life. So of course, talking with her and trying to understand some of that context is really important. And the women in the study that talked about academic advisors being really sensitive to the multiple roles, I think what they were emphasizing was that these advisors really talked with them and helped them think through, but didn't make the decision for them. Now, I say that, but I also do share some of my own personal experiences in that I kind of plowed through my education and then coming on as a faculty member and not kind of stopping, and looking back similarly as one of the participants and thinking, you know, I kind of wish I did. And so I share this with the students, and again, let them use that at whatever, however they'd like, and also this study sharing of the three women's experiences and how those that did really felt that it was the best thing to do and the one that didn't really regretted it. So I share that, but again, want to support what the woman believes and wants, and also having the conversation around, well, you know, our culture, you know, there's certain beliefs and what are your supports. And so not so much buying into that a woman should take the time off, but also not prescribing that she shouldn't. So I think that's a great question and one definitely for discussion. I'm wondering if anyone else has some ideas or suggestions around that.
I see. Oh, sorry, it's Deb here. I see on the direct messaging that Kathy Kavanaugh would like to get on the speaker's list. Kathy Bray, I'll let you respond first, then Kathy Kavanaugh, then Carolyn Park.
Thanks, Gina and Deb. And yes, indeed, we need to help students make their own decisions for themselves, and it's neither a should nor a shouldn't answer. I'm just glad to know that it's no longer keep going. Thanks.
Hi. Okay, I guess I'm on here now. Kathy Kavanaugh. This is my first time on a webinar, so I'm a bit awkward with it. However, Gina, I did want to say that I enjoyed your presentation. I was particularly interested in the ways in which your program is designed to accommodate women, especially new mothers. the family center leave, absences, extensions, allowed for three weeks, no online. And maybe there are some things that the university can consider more generally, because after all, the student body at Alaska is two-thirds women, not all, of course, of those women have young children. But many are facing issues of, multiple workloads. And so I like the idea, for example, of a free week, no online for a week. Giving them a message that the complexity of their contemporary life is recognized by the institution. And by doing that, I think they would at the same time affirm their own ambition to an intellectual life. I think that's an extremely important message that the university can send to our students. I have a couple of questions. It wasn't clear to me whether the students in your study were working in a cohort or not. It's interesting that literature in distance ed, women in distance ed, gender in distance ed, indicates that majority of students choose distance ed as a second choice. It's not their first choice. I'd be interested to know if you asked your students whether distance ed was their first choice, why they were in the program that attracted them to them, that sort of thing. And then it's a question of whether these accommodations in the program are part of something that attracts students to the program, or is it more a question of keeping them in the program because of these accommodations? I think I'll leave it there and maybe have you respond. Now I'm going to try and get off of this. Thanks.
Kathy, it's Deb here. You were breaking up slightly. I just want to quick summarize, and I'll see if I've got this right. Under the questions, I've got the first one, whether or not the students in the study were in a cohort or not. Secondly, whether or not students have the option of being in a cohort or not in a cohort. And the third is the accommodations for these. Are these primarily to attract students into the program, or are they to keep students in the program once they're in? Just let me know if I've got those pretty well set.
Yes, that does it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Kathy, for those questions. First of all, in terms of whether the students in our program move through the education in a cohort, and our program is constructed to be a three-year program, and so just for that reason alone, the students that start together are defined as a cohort group. Now, those that choose to accelerate the program and take a two-year rather than the three-year, or to decelerate and slow down their program, then end up not pacing through the program at the same rate as their cohort, that being the students that they started with. And so that's a choice that happens when there is some changes in their program plans, which happens, and the students recognize that they have a support group that develops that might change if they make some of these adjustments to their program. But I've witnessed lots of students in our program, both male and female, take advantage of accelerating or decelerating and thereby changing their cohort to being a different group and still finding the same supports within the new cohort group. Now, the next question was whether it's a choice of being in the cohort group, and I think that partially answers it in terms of when they restructure their program plan, it automatically means that they're not going to be moving through the same courses with the same students, that automatically it means that they'll be with different students in other courses and likely joining a different cohort group. And then lastly, the accommodations that our participants talked about with the institutional supports, did I see them as keeping the students in the program or attracting them? And I would have to say at the moment, when you look at our website, that some of these features are discussed, but they aren't obvious. And I think that what's happened over time is that it's become something that our program, once you're in the program, these different options and accommodations become more apparent or options to the students. It's not something that we advertise per se, but that's, you know, that's something maybe we should think about, because I think these are things that help students move through our program. So at the moment, they are keeping our students rather than attracting them.
We have time for one more question. Carolyn, I have you on my list.
Okay. Actually, Gina, this has really caused me to think in a totally different line, because as you're well aware, we have a lot of women students in our nursing masters and many pregnant women every term. And I myself deliberately went and did my master's degree when I was pregnant, because it struck me as then I would have time to do it. And I think a lot of our students look at it that way. So I always perceived it as a positive to be able to go to school because you were on maternity leave. But it doesn't mean that those factors don't still apply and all those other things, so that's great. But I wanted to suggest that if you wanted a larger cohort of participants for the study, to consider perhaps drawing students from our program.
Absolutely, Carolyn, and I've been thinking and looking around at other programs at Athabasca, and nursing really jumped out, because I know that there is a predominance of women in your program also. And your first comment about this actually being an ideal time to enter graduate studies, I would agree with that, because I think that there is some, I guess, things about the time of mothering and pregnancy that allows there to be some time for a woman to focus on something like studies that is more sort of you know, mental than any kind of physical work per se, although depending what program you're in, but that it can be an ideal time. And noticeably, women do believe this as well, because they are taking that opportunity to have babies while in graduate programs. And so I do support, and I do think that this is really a nice balance, but that there can be challenges, and that my work in this area is to look at those challenges so that we can help minimize any barriers in the way, because I think it should be a time, an ideal time for women to enhance their credentials and finish their studies and move on.
Thank you, everyone. This is Deb. We'll be closing the session now. There will be an all staff coming out shortly that will identify the link if you'd like to review the information or have a look at things again. And Gina is available for further questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.